From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we learn how current overdose and homicide deaths compare to rates pre-coronavirus. Then contributor Joanne Nelson joins us to talk about her new memoir, This Is How We Leave.
If I could sum it up in one word, I think it would be resiliency. And I think what I would like people to take away is that there are a lot of ways to turn out and to get through hard times and come out positive.
Then artist Luba Lakova talks about creating work that responds to social justice movements.
I think as an artist, I feel you need to just step back a little bit and reflect and really think about it and then transform it through the prism of art and give it this artistic filter which makes it unifying.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In a tweet earlier this month, the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office said in just the span of 1 week, they investigated 43 natural deaths, 8 homicides, 8 probable overdoses, 6 accidental deaths, 5 COVID deaths, and 2 suicides. If trends continue, the office expects to break 2019's fatal overdose rate by nearly 100 deaths. The coronavirus pandemic has certainly complicated many aspects of our lives, but how does it impact tracking deaths? And has the pandemic significantly worsened overdose and homicide rates? Sarah Schreiber is the Forensic Technical Director of the Medical Examiner's Office, and she joins me now to explain how the latest numbers compare to circumstances pre-COVID. Sarah Schreiber, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
So what kind of year are we having for overdose and homicide deaths, and how does it compare to circumstances pre-coronavirus?
So far, 2020 has seemed to trend in an upward direction, both related to homicides and drug-related deaths, when we compare those statistics to the numbers from last year.
So, and is there like an average number per week of these deaths that we see, or is it more so per month, or what are the trends that you're able to keep track of?
We're definitely showing an increase overall. What's probably the most prominent, though, is looking at the weekly statistics. Last year, we were estimating 8 drug deaths per week, and this year, we are estimating 11 drug deaths per week.
So in addition to drug deaths, there's also, of course, a rise in deaths related to the coronavirus. And it's been shown that COVID has disproportionately affected people of color. What are, for lack of a better term, the death demographics that really stand out to you in most recent reports?
I think what's important to note about the statistics related to demographics is that we haven't seen a change. We are still showing the same approximate percentages across the racial diversity within Milwaukee County related to drug death.
In a September 15th tweet, the Medical Examiner's Office said within the last 7 days from that tweet, they investigated 43 natural deaths, 8 homicides, 8 probable overdoses, 6 accidental deaths, 5 COVID deaths, and 2 suicides. And obviously, this is really sobering to have within 1 week. As much as we can rely on, say, trends in paces of death, is this expected to continue for a long time?
It's difficult for our office to assess the trend as it continues. What we can really rely upon is that we won't expect to see dramatic changes in a short period of time. Nothing in our history has shown for that to happen. We don't see dramatic change from one extreme to the other or vice versa. So I would expect these numbers to stay fairly consistent for some time, with hopefully some ebbs and flows within that as a trend.
It was noted that if these trends continue, the office expects 514 fatal overdoses, which would break the record of 2019 by nearly 100. You mentioned nothing changes quickly, but this is still a big significance, a big difference in numbers.
That's correct. Those are our estimations based on the trends and the increases that we have seen in 2020. I speak to no change happening very dramatically in the instance that this didn't happen within a month or 2 months, but this is the trend and the average as it has increased over the last 12 months. So the average of number of cases per week has increased by about 3. Some of those turn out to be drug-related deaths and some do not. And likely some that we didn't consider were going to be drug deaths on initial investigation do turn out to be a drug death. So we have some variance within that case as it comes in as a probable. But that said, averaging 100 over 365 days is a difference of, you know, less than one a day. So it's not a huge dramatic change, but it is definitely significant when you look at it as an overall total.
Definitely. And when it comes to tracking overdose death numbers, is there any circumstances in which they are also considered suicide deaths? How do you keep record of or determine these kind of things?
Over the course of the investigation, our medical investigators will talk to individuals related to the decedent, both family and friends, those that last spoke with the individual. In order for a drug-related death to be signed with a manner of suicide, we need to find evidence from the investigation that undoubtedly supports that, whether that be a note left behind, a last phone call, a last social media post, something to that effect, something that speaks to that as an intent. If we cannot find that conclusively, our office takes the conservative approach of signing all of those drug-related deaths as an accident, as a manner.
So does that attribute to keeping record of what is accidental overdoses?
Correct. Those would all be classified as accidental overdose as opposed to a suicide by drug-related means.
So is there an increase in drug suicide versus other methods in relation to the rising overdose rates?
At this point, I can't attribute a drug-related cause as in the increase in suicides that we have seen. Last year, we totaled 11 drug-related suicides, and so far this year, we have had 6 drug-related suicides. Some are still potentially pending, and we still have 3 months of the year to go. So that seems like a pretty dramatic decrease, but there's still 3 months to go, and we're probably, on average, 2 months behind on drug results and signing of those cases.
So are there any new substances that are attributing to overdose deaths? I mean, we often think of heroin, other basic things that can come straight to mind that can be treated relatively successfully with Narcan. But in the case of overdoses, are there new drugs or combinations that are attributing to perhaps higher rates?
Unfortunately, since the beginning of the year, we have identified several new substances in drug-related deaths. Isotonidazine, etisalam, rorphine, and flualprazolam are some of those, to be specific about a few. Isotonidazine and rorphine are very potent opioids that we're finding in combination with an already potent opioid, that being fentanyl, in many of these cases. This combination definitely speaks to the increase in danger associated and the risk associated with using these substances and the consequent number of cases that we have that have been signed as a death related to those substances themselves.
So when it comes to all of the deaths, whether attributed to natural homicide, overdoses, suicide, COVID, medical examiners are licensed for just a certain amount of autopsies. So what is that limit? And do you fear that you might be reaching it too soon? You know, under the circumstances, has anything changed for medical examiners in regards to what they're able to complete within the year?
According to our accreditation through the National Association of Medical Examiners, each pathologist is supposed to do between 250 and 325 autopsies a year. That is a cumulative total. So our office on the high end is allowed to investigate up to 1,950 cases before our accreditation would become in question and we might go into a provisional status. So the number of autopsies is covered by 6 pathologists in this office. So we have quite a volume that we are able to maintain. With this increase in death investigations as a whole, from whatever cause, as long as they require an autopsy, those kinds of considerations definitely come into play with these numbers that are allowable under our accreditation. If we push the limits of the accreditation, either we need to add more staffing or we run the risk of losing our accreditation and go to a provisional status.
And how has reported deaths under COVID-19 changed? There's been a lot of talk around how causes of death are listed when coronavirus is involved, how that may skew national numbers, things of that sort. But when it comes to Milwaukee County, what is the protocol?
The protocol for signing the death investigations as related to COVID really is that falls into the jurisdiction of the pathologist, not the toxicology lab at all. But there is guidance provided from the CDC to help us with this determination and the proper certifications.
So do cities like Milwaukee or other cities of similar size have room for the bodies in these circumstances of rising death rates? I mean, at the beginning and peak of the COVID-19 pandemic, we saw the reports from New York of cooler trucks being brought in and their inability to handle that capacity, as well as places like Italy, other places around the world. Do you fear that that could be an issue coming up?
Unfortunately, related to the death numbers and the death investigations that our office is handling, we've already had to bring in a truck for extra storage space. This isn't necessarily related to COVID-related cases, as those don't get examined in our office. They're simply a medical record investigation behind those cases. But this is just to do storage for the bodies that we do perform an autopsy on and do examine here in this office. We have had to provide additional refrigerated truck storage for that space.
So, of course, everyone going through the pandemic sees it through their own unique circumstances. You, being a forensic technical director, how have you viewed these things and how has it impacted you?
The increase in caseload has definitely affected the toxicology lab, requiring more instrumentation and more efficiencies put into the analysis that we're performing. Identification of new substances has added to that challenge, as we have to build assays in order to confirm these substances in order for them to be reported to our pathologists for inclusion in the certification of death and ultimately making that death certificate. So the workload has increased, but from all really sorts and causes of death, not just drug-related causes.
And even though, you know, of course, your information is coming from the unfortunate circumstance of people dying, is it still a way of helping others?
Yes, it is unfortunate, the statistics that we have behind our data, but the good news is that that data is always used to help prevent deaths in the future. Information about new drugs that are being used and abused can be used by folks from emergency medicine in how to treat individuals, to those that deal with helping those in recovery, to assisting individuals as they battle through those things, as well as law enforcement as they work to try to keep these substances off the street and knowing what those substances are. Ultimately, the information is just that. It's information and it can be used for many different purposes. And therefore, our office tries very hard to be transparent with that data and our statistics as much as we can in order to help out as many of those in our community as we can.
So, of course, all of us can process statistics a little differently, but what's the main message that you or your office want people to know about the immediate future as numbers of COVID cases continue to rise in the state and, of course, the overdose deaths that you mentioned and all of these other factors that you all deal with on a daily basis?
I think it's important to keep the light shining on other causes of death. Drug-related death, as we've pointed out today, is still increasing. The array of substances is still changing. We've already surpassed the numbers related to particular analytes that we had in all of last year, and it's only September this year. Keeping a mindful eye for individuals that are suffering with these kinds of substance use disorders is certainly very beneficial, and we can help to slow the increase in these preventable drug deaths.
Well, Sarah Schreiber, thank you so much for joining us today to help us break down the meaning behind all of these numbers.
Thank you very much.
Sarah Schreiber is the Forensic Technical Director of Milwaukee's Medical Examiner's Office. And this is day one of our WUWM Fall On-Air Member Drive. Thank you for listening to Lake Effect, first of all, and thank you for donating if you have already. If you haven't yet, today's a great day to mark it. We don't have to wait until our last day of fund drive for you to become a member or just a one-time contributor. Any level is great, and we appreciate your support. And, you know, while stories change every day, our commitment to serving you is completely steadfast. We are here with you with what you need in this moment, especially now during the COVID-19 pandemic, as I'm now working from home talking to you now. regardless of where we are, our mission is public service. You are the public in public radio, and our member drives fund that service and bring you more uninterrupted, fact-based news at a time when you need it most. And here at WUWM, your access to accurate information is, of course, our priority, especially right now. It's stories like this one where we think about how does coronavirus impact things at the medical examiner's office, and other segments in our show that you'll hear on Lake Effect or during Morning Edition, All Things Considered, all throughout the day on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. The news you're counting on requires financial resources in order to produce all of these shows. And it's the community support that accounts for more than 80% of our annual budget. So even though we are working remotely and circumstances have changed and the stories are ever constantly changing and present, our need for public support has not changed. In fact, it's needed now more than ever. So today on day one of our WUWM Fall On Air member drive, we encourage you to go to wuwm.com/give and select what level's right for you. No amount is too small, and every bit helps us reach our goal. So again, you can go to wuwm.com/give, or you can call 414-227-3210, or even go to our app and hit the red donate button. It'll take less than a couple minutes of your day to bring you many, many more minutes of coverage and programming like Lake Effect that you rely on. Again, 414-227-3210, or go to wuwm.com/give. We'll take a break and then return with writer Joanne Nelson. She'll join us to talk about her new memoir, This Is How We Leave. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. You may have heard contributor Joanne Nelson's essays on Lake Effect before. For Nelson, writing has always been a way to not just escape, but process things in her life. Her new memoir, This Is How We Leave, is a collection of essays that span Nelson's life, from her Milwaukee working-class Catholic school upbringing to building her own family while juggling her past. Amidst the background of a family filled with abandonment, disruption, emotional abuse, and alcoholism, Nelson walks readers through her life's memories with detail, humor, and empathy. She joins me now to share more about her new memoir. Joanne Nelson, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So this is the first time we've had a bit of a different format. Normally our listeners hear your essays and commentaries, but this time around, we're here to talk about your new memoir, This Is How We Leave. So before we get into the content of this book, I'm wondering, when did writing become a tool or a form of release for you?
That's such a wonderful question. I think when I was young, I remember in second grade getting some praise for a story. I think it was about some kids who got stuck in a drainage pipe. Clearly, since I remember that, it must have been important. But so I got this nice attention and I liked it. So throughout my life, there's been periods of a lot of writing, periods of not writing. I think in terms of an outlet, I've always journaled, and I even remember specifically in college journaling a lot to try and figure out what I was feeling and what I was doing.
So this book, This Is How We Leave, is a memoir, and it's a collection of essays. So how did this come together? I know you've always been writing, and you have maybe single pieces or commentaries, and these all kind of weave together throughout a timeline. So did you see that your essay collection kept growing and then realize like, hey, I can make this work and transform this into a book?
Mm-hmm. I did see it as an essay collection. And when I submitted it to Vine Leaves Press and they wrote me a letter of offer, in that letter, they said they saw it more as a memoir than a collection of essays. And they wrote me such a thorough letter all about the book that I was so curious about their view of it that I wanted to go with it as a memoir. So I said, okay. And part of their editing process involves helping smooth those transitions and making the timeline all work together. So there was a wonderful give and take of guidance with the publisher.
I find that really interesting that they're the ones who said, well, we see this as a memoir versus how you went into it initially, though. And of course, this spans throughout your life. And I want to bring up a part of your book that is you sitting with your mom and a nun of a school here in Milwaukee. So here's the quote. "Mostly, though, I found emotions both dangerous and ineffective. Signs of anger led to punishment and tears led to teasing. Better to keep my head down, withdraw inside, and embrace being, quote, stone." So I can see this approach not just in how you move through your family's dynamics as a young girl growing older, but also in the way your writing presents like plain details. You know, that's kind of your grounding way of approaching things. So you mentioned you kind of have written on and off, but did writing play a role in helping you remain stone and fill your pages with processing and emotions and be able to be stone face in the outer world and then be able to withdraw inside?
I would assume so. In the moment, I certainly didn't have that kind of wisdom available to me to see it that way. But I would assume that that was sort of a saving grace to kind of almost have that friend next to me that I could tell stuff to that I didn't trust anyone else with, even as a youngster. Although I think probably, let me see, at that age, I probably wasn't getting in depth in my journaling. It was probably more of a cataloging of events, but still it felt like a safe place to go.
With this book spanning throughout your life, of course, it brings the whole concept of memories, right? So did you struggle with memory in the sense of writing what may have, say, plainly happened if like an outside perspective was there versus the way you saw it or process it according to your age or because of approaching it as a writer and wanting to remember certain details or creative ways of presenting these events?
Well, when you write creative nonfiction, you try to look at things in two ways. There's the situation that happened. The nun rips up my book. But there's also the story and the meaning that you understand as you age and develop a greater understanding of everything. And so when you're writing creative nonfiction, I think you try to bring all that to bear. So there's that incident with the nun, but there's also my understanding of she was a person and who knows what was going on for her. And also in looking at the bigger picture of myself and my desire to not create a problem that'll get me more attention and more teasing in my life. So there's that dual perspective that I think is very, very important. In terms of the memories, I tried very hard to really be very strict with this really happened and not add something creative to that. Or, you know, there are plenty of wonderful nonfiction writers who are really okay with making a composite character of two or three people. And I never did that. That just doesn't fit for me. So the things that are presented are to the best of my ability, truly what happened. There are plenty of places in the memoir where I talk about I assume or I imagine. And that's what I do with the areas where I'm not so sure.
This book goes through a lot of things and harrowing events like family abandonment, an alcoholic mother who also dealt with depression, anxiety, drug abuse, and the trauma of being raised under these circumstances. So how did you immerse yourself in constantly, I'm sure, editing these pieces, going through them over and over, writing them in the first place? How do you do that and then take care of yourself?
Oh, that's another wonderful question. I think when you do the first couple drafts is when the emotion really comes up. So to sit and let that play out and see where you feel it in your body, and maybe that also needs to be added to the narrative, is the first place to go. Secondly, is to get outside for lots of walks. And I think for me, that maybe opposite thing of, you know, when you're writing, you're really closed in a space and inside your head. But then to do the opposite of self-care, which for me is getting outside and moving and working that through. Some of these essays have really been in play for up to 8 years. So by time I'm doing the editing that happened over the last year, it doesn't have an emotional feel, or very rarely has an emotional feel. It's more a piece I'm really trying to work on and shape in word choice and detail choice to the best of my ability.
With some of those times ranging up to 8 years through writing, editing, continuously changing how you present these essays, did that change your relationship with how you viewed these people or events previously?
It did. And I think that was wonderful about the process from Vine Leaves Press, and that one of their editing levels is kind of this big picture level. So that editor would say things like, you know, in that essay about keys, if you took the last third of that and added it to the essay here about riptides, that might be really cool. And my first thought would be, you know, my babies, how can you move those words? But of course, I was part of this process, so I'd give it a try. And then I'd be like, boy, that fits, that works there. So some of that was being willing to play with those words and move them around. And there was, during that stage, I had printed out the, I don't know, 160 pages or whatever, and I had them spread out across two rooms of my house because I needed the visual of seeing what it looked like if you moved words over here and how that felt. And so mostly it was a good experience, but I think there's no way I could, as a writer, deal with material that was very fresh. It would just be too much of feeling like your darlings you were killing. But at this point, I was at least willing to try the experiment. And in terms of how this affected my relationship with the characters, something that surprised me, because as I had said, there wasn't, you know, a lot of emotional reactions at this point. But something that surprised me is one of the pieces I was moving around and then writing a little bit where there was, there needed to be some more information about my dad. So I was trying to write something. And I felt like I learned a brand new thing that, like, it had never occurred to me to think about what was it like for him to come and pick up this sullen teenager who, you know, his ex-wife didn't want him to be around. And yet he kept doing it. And it was in a late stage of editing that I finally really thought about what that must have been like for him. So there's an example of when it changed my relationship to characters.
Right, seeing them down the road. Oh, they're people too, you know?
Yeah, who knew?
Well, in the title, this didn't really occur to me until I was just about to hop on this call with you, but This Is How We Leave. Do you see that as like your family legacy or theme, or what does it mean to you? What is the title?
Yeah. Way back, when this was a collection of essays, long before I sent it to this publisher, I had titled the book the same title as one of the essays, If Not for the Mess. And I really like that title. But one time, a very kind person who rejected it sent me a really nice letter about needing to find more of a theme that wove through. And when I read his letter, it's almost like I had this aha about how much leaving is in this book. And that's when the new title came to me. And it really cemented things for me as I started to look at you know, these generations of men leaving, but also the other ways that I leave, like by clamming up, you know, and not saying something, or by reading as much as I do, especially as a kid. I just totally left any bad situation through literature, which, you know, is maybe better than drugs, but of course it is. But it's another way of leaving. So sometimes we leave in really positive ways. Sometimes we leave by just daydreaming a lot.
Well, and to have this collection of This Is How We Leave now be able to be shared with so many people, you are inviting people to into your life. And I want to bring up another quote. And this was during an essay when you were reflecting on when your mother's health was declining and she was being moved from a hospital to a care facility. And you were trying to keep all this from your husband and your daughters. And you said, quote, "I wanted this drama kept separate from my husband and children, from my life." So your essays indeed share the same sentiment as you come into yourself throughout the years. So how do you feel literally putting your drama on a page in a book plainly for your family and for people you don't even know to see and invite them into your life?
Yes, that. I think it's the distance and the timeline that allows that. At the time of writing that and feeling that when we were living it, I was so angry that it was taking the time from my current family and putting on them something I had to give up some childhood for. So somehow it doesn't bother me as much to have it happen later. And they've read this before. They've all read the book beforehand, so they were not surprised by things.
So has this book sparked more conversations with your family and particularly with your daughters?
Yes, it has, because even though they had read it before, I think they read it with a different eye. You know, especially I had asked both my daughters in final edits, I said, "Will you just read this and try to catch small errors, you know, spellings or a period or whatever." And so I think that had them looking at it with a different eye also. And so it did, there was questions they would say like, "Boy, I didn't really realize that it was that bad with grandma," or, you know, just another memory that they then kind of wanted to explore.
What do you want people to feel or take away from sharing and reading your story, your family stories?
Well, if I could sum it up in one word, I think it would be resiliency. And I think what I would like people to take away is that there are a lot of ways to turn out and to get through hard times and come out positive and use that past to help others. So I hope it would lend hope and help people find their own ways to be resilient during difficult times.
Well, Joanne, it's certainly a great collection, and I thank you for your work on it and for talking with me about it today.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to get to chat with you.
Lake Effect contributor Joanne Nelson lives in Heartland, Wisconsin, and she's the author of This Is How We Leave, which is out now. You can also explore her other essays at wuwm.com. And it's also at wuwm.com/give where you can donate to our Fall On Air member drive. This is day one of our member drive, and even though, you know, it looks physically, well, not on the radio, but for us, it's physically different. I'm here recording from my in-home studio, but throughout all of this, we have remained a vital source to you, our listeners. In a time when the news is ever-changing and we head from the deepest part of this crisis to perhaps a cautious emergence to a new normal, there's a lot of uncertainty about what the future holds. But overall, you can trust that WUWM will be here with deep and reliable and essential news to help you navigate our new reality. Every gift is meaningful, and if you're able to give, we would welcome your contribution for our fundraising effort. You can do that by going to wuwm.com/give or call 414-227-3210, and you can even go to our WUWM app and hit the red donate button. Any level is appreciated, and we count on you to keep us on the air. So thank you for listening and for being part of our public radio family, and of course for your enduring support. Coming up, we'll explore the work of poster artist Luba Lakova and her new exhibit at the Jewish Museum, Milwaukee. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The past year has been difficult for museums. At the beginning of the pandemic, many were scrambling to figure out how to move their work into the digital space. And as the pandemic has continued, there was the question of how to keep visitors engaged in a non-traditional museum space. Now, as spaces have been reopening, there's the question of how to engage visitors in person safely. For the Jewish Museum Milwaukee, the last year has been challenging, but it hasn't stopped them from bringing in new exhibits. Their latest is called Luba Lakova, Designing Justice, and features a retrospective of the visual artist's work, which has become an iconic symbol of social justice movements around the world. Lukova joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers, along with museum curator Molly Dubin, to talk about the exhibit, her work, and the iconography of social justice.
So I'm curious to know just the logistics in the first place of creating an exhibit right now. It must be so complicated. What has that process been like for you?
It's been a really interesting process. You know, as so many other museums, we, of course, needed to close. And my colleagues and I were all working remotely for many, many months. And we were in a position where the exhibit we had just opened basically, you know, was now no longer available. And we just reopened to the public in mid-August. We were able to extend the exhibit that we had by a little bit. So aside from the fact that it had been closed for, you know, the majority of time that it was up, we had a little bit of an opportunity. But, you know, there was this whole kind of period of kind of juggling with plates in the air of trying to figure out, you know, what do we have to do? What do we have to adjust? You know, Luba Lukova's Designing Justice was supposed to be the summer exhibit. We were, you know, coordinating with the DNC. There's so many of the social justice issues that are, you know, addressed so poignantly in her work that we knew we were going to be at the forefront of discussion. And then the pandemic hit and there really wasn't, you know, much of a DNC. And so there was some uncertainty whether it would even take place. And we were so thrilled and appreciative to Luba to be able to have some flexibility in working with us, and to the Museum of Design Atlanta, who we, you know, really work with to make this happen, that we were allowed to shift it. You know, we were able to shift it to the fall. And, you know, one of the silver linings, if you want to say that, in the midst of, you know, everything that's going on, it almost, you know, feels more poignant, more fitting, more timely that this is happening right now, because social justice is what is on everyone's mind, what everyone is talking about. It is the topic of the moment. We've, of course, taken all kinds of safety precautions in our reopening to allow us to welcome back visitors safely. We have moved to an online ticketing system. We cap the number of visitors, you know, that can come into the space at any one time. We've, of course, got stations with hand sanitizer. We have gloves and styluses for our interactives. When you first walk into the space, we have a system set up that scans for temperatures. We have a taped out one-way path throughout the permanent exhibit and changing exhibit that helps to keep social distancing. So we put all the precautions in place, and this is just such a powerful exhibit. We really hope that people are going to come in and physically experience it and interact with it.
Yes. I just would like to add something that the Museum of Atlanta did to bring the work to you, because these prints are framed and they're under glass, which is very heavy. And some of the frames are huge, 40 by 60 inches. And when the pandemic hit, the Museum of Atlanta basically closed. I didn't have any staff, people to bring the work from the storage space and then transport it to Milwaukee. So only one person, one guy, I believe, from Atlanta was able to do the whole thing. He was the only one that the museum could hire to do that. And luckily, everything went in a perfect shape to Milwaukee. And I saw the pictures. They look really great. The space looks wonderful. But it's a lot of work behind the scene, behind the stage, and with very limited staff. So everybody worked like under pressure, and we did more than we usually do for something like that. But in the end, it worked well. And so happy that you are up and for people to see it, even with limited capacity, but to experience it in person. Because besides the work, there are two walls with interactive elements where people will connect with the colorful strings, different pools, or I don't know how to say it, but they will create their life story. So to be able to do that in a time of extreme situation with hygiene and all that in the public space, I think it's incredible. So yeah, but the Museum of Atlanta too did a great job for transporting everything and adjusting it to the new space, which is completely different than when the exhibit was first shown in a different configuration in Atlanta. So yeah, I think it worked really well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for saying that, Luba, about the transportation logistics. Obviously, you know, shipping things, we normally, you know, oftentimes things will come via air, and that was a big challenge. I mean, and even, you know, going ground, all the issues in the interruptions in, you know, the postal system, those were all things that had to be factored in. And the fact that, you know, Laura at the Museum of Design Atlanta, the executive director there, was able to coordinate for one gentleman to, you know, load up the truck. And basically he just drove straight through from Atlanta to Milwaukee. We unloaded everything, you know, and he turned around and went back. And yeah, if that had not happened, it would have been even more complicated.
Yeah.
Everything right now, because of the pandemic, you know, is a lot more difficult. As you mentioned, of course, there have been issues with the mail. There have been issues with many of the systems that we rely on to make these things happen. Now, I'd like to get a bit back into your artwork, Luba. How do you describe your work for people who aren't familiar with it?
Well, I will say that it's humanistic, it's to the point, it's current. And I always describe myself as a blue collar artist because I deal with these issues that hit us in the face every day. I don't let it wait for too long, just keep the energy of the moment. So that's what I would say. It's very colorful, it's bright, and I think it catches the eyes because of that, but it's really to the point. And it's open for interpretation too, but it's straightforward addressing issues. And also what I would say is trying to visualize issues that we all know in an unexpected way with some twists, with some metaphoric twist. But it's humanistic in the first place, I would say. There's always a human element in it.
She's being incredibly humble, incredibly humble. I mean, you are. So many people, you know, commented on that were in the virtual audience at the opening. I mean, I'm guessing, Joy, you've had an opportunity to read some of the background in the press release information, but Luba's work has been utilized around the world for so many purposes. You know, the medium itself, you know, the poster medium, when you think about protest and, you know, you think about, you know, grassroots efforts, of course, that's the medium of the masses, really. That, you know, when you think about the civil rights movement or the Vietnam War or events around the world, you know, what is the medium that people use? It's the poster. So I think that there's that fundamental, incredible connection, you know, and the fact that just her images have spoken so powerfully to countries that have taken her images, used them for protests. The Obama administration, her work was displayed, her original social justice portfolio was displayed at Obama's first inauguration, and several her healthcare or, you know, health coverage image was, you know, really taken and utilized. There's another piece, Upward Mobility, that was shown in the New York Times, correct? That accompanied an article about Hillary Clinton's campaign dealing with poverty. I mean, her images have been utilized by, you know, some of the most, you know, some of the biggest figures in our nation, and as I said earlier, around the world. So, and they've gone viral in many instances. And that just speaks to the power of how they connect with people.
You know, when you think about the movements that are happening right now, Luba, I mean, you've been doing this work for a long time, for a lot of different movements, but there is so much happening in the United States right now. How do you see your art playing into this movement, and how do you see your art being impacted by the energy of this moment?
Well, I have to tell you that what we see now is kind of the tip of an iceberg, you know, because these energies, these ideas were bubbling for many, many years. For I think throughout even the entire contemporary history, these same issues, they have not disappeared. They exist, and they maybe take a different form each decade or in particular moments of history. But in general, this idea about the struggle, the fundamental justice that we all want and need in our world is always there. And that's to me also the fundamental topic of art in general, because think about, at least for me, all the artworks like literature, theater, music that I admire, they speak, even if they were written hundreds of years ago or decades ago, they speak to us and they never get old. So in that sense, for me, I don't think I have to adjust or change as an artist because I've always done that. And if you can see in the exhibition at the Jewish Museum, if you read the label, some images are 20 years old, you know, and they seem like people think I just did it for something. So even if you think about this racial unrest and civil unrest we have now, that's not new. It's been always there. We feel we're getting better in some areas, but something happens and it shows us it's not perfect yet. So we need to keep working and keep addressing that. But what I could say about my work is that I think sometimes we are bombarded with so much news, like almost every day something new happens. And I think as an artist, I feel you need to just step back a little bit and reflect and really think about it and then transform it through the prism of art and give it this artistic filter which makes it unifying, because I don't want my work to call for even more violence and even more bad things that ruin the core of our humanity. I want us to unite and to work together and to really love and respect each other. That's truly the message of my work. Even if I recognize certain problems that are beyond even the capacity of art, because not everything art can resolve, but at least art can inspire you to be compassionate, to feel empathy, and to put yourself in the position of someone else who you're not, you know. So that's basically what I do. I want to always want it to be current, to reflect on what's going on, but then to send a message of unity and of only the generosity that art can bring to the table. And I always say art is beyond politics, even if some people can call it political, but it needs to be beyond that and talk about our shared humanity. So yeah, that's my message really in this situation. And everything I do and have done in the past seems like I just did it yesterday for something that we're experiencing now. But yeah, that's my message.
Was going to say that, Luba, you should, you know, talk about, there's a couple, but in light of what you just said and the fact that, you know, so many of these images were created now, you know, over 12 years ago, mm-hmm. but are so much at the forefront and to some extent much more so. Certainly we've seen, you know, the impact of COVID on the disproportionate, you know, impact, you know, on brown and black households and, you know, in some of these communities and populations that are already, we're already struggling, you know, now those issues have amplified. So I was going to say you should talk about, she did an incredible piece for the 50th anniversary of the civil rights movement that as Luba just said, looks like it was done in response to this moment.
I definitely think so. And unfortunately, that's how I think it is. You know, humanity will never be perfect. It's this, most profound characteristics of humanity that we are between two forces, the good and the evil, and we have to find our path, and we have to not lose our focus of working for justice and working for the good. In every situation that I've been positioned, I feel it's the same conflict and the same dilemma, the same duality that you have to resolve with images. But in my work, I want this to be current and to be really specific for an issue. But the core of it to me remains the same in almost everything I do. In almost every image, you can see that duality of forces that that struggle, that in the end you have to look for the light in the situation and for the positive aspect of it. Yeah. Even when you draw something that is not looking pretty, the purpose of it is to realize that this is a call for action to make something right, you know.
Luba Lakova is a visual artist whose posters have become an iconic symbol of social justice movements around the world. Molly Dubin is a curator of the Jewish Museum Milwaukee, which is currently featuring an exhibit of Lakova's work titled Designing Justice. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you can see examples of Lakova's work at WUWM.com. And again, WUWM.com/give is where you can give either your one-time or sustaining membership support to your Milwaukee's NPR station. Especially right now, the programs that we bring you and the community it builds is indispensable. So please support this now by going to wuwm.com/give or by calling 414-227-3210, or you can also go on the app and hit the red donate button. We look forward to your support, and we also look forward to continue making the programming that you rely on. That's today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.